This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Local author, historian, cartographer Rick Britton joins me live in studio. He's online at rickbritton.com, and you are here to continue our conversation of the most significant battles of the U.S. Civil War that took place in Virginia. But before we do, get us updated about all the other projects that you have going on.
Oh man, got a bunch of stuff going on. We've got the ongoing Civil War lecture and day trip series at the Senior Center. So every month on one of the last Wednesdays, we have a free lecture, and then on a Wednesday, and then the following Wednesday, we go to see that site or that battlefield. So this month in August, we're having a speaker come to talk to us about the Virginia Military Institute in the Civil War. Tremendous amount of influence, as you can imagine.
Battle of the Bloody Shoes, right?
Yeah, the Battle of New Market, but then also all of the officers who fought for the Confederacy who were trained at VMI. So there's a lot about that. So it's going to be a fascinating talk. Colonel Keith Gibson is coming up from VMI to give us that presentation. And then the very next week on Wednesday, we're going to go down and see Lexington. And there is so much great Civil War stuff to see in Lexington. We're going to see, for example, Stonewall Jackson's final resting place. We're going to see the Lee Chapel, Robert E. Lee's final resting place. We're going to see the Stonewall Jackson house, where we're going to take a tour, the only house that he and his second wife ever owned. And then we're going to go see the VMI Museum, which has some incredible pieces. It has, for example, it has Stonewall Jackson's horse stuffed, little sorrel.
Yeah.
And it has the slicker he was wearing when he was mortally wounded at Chancellorsville.
How does something like that survive?
It's amazing.
How does somebody pull it off of his body and say, let's keep this?
I was just reading about that the other day. It went through a really circuitous route, and some guy just ended up with it in his barn. And then he took it out and put it on because it was raining. And then he remembered, oh, yeah, this is the black slicker, you know, like a raincoat that Jackson was wearing. And then he realized, well, you know, I really ought to get it to somebody so that this thing can be displayed. But, you know, the thing just sat in somebody's barn for ages.
You know what else is down there right by Lee Chapel is the burial place of Traveler.
Right.
Lee's horse is there as well.
Right, right.
And that's a beautiful town. Used to live there. Spent a couple of years there.
It's a fantastic town.
It really
is
nice.
If you can imagine Charlottesville from at least 30 years ago, that's how I like to think of Lexington. You know, Charlottesville has grown exponentially in 30 years. Lexington still has that small town feel. You know, you can drive down the street. I love to tell people this story, and you can wave to people. I'm terrible about this. I love to wave to people, and people will wave back in Lexington.
Yeah, they do.
You know, here in Charlottesville, they'll look at you and they'll go, Do I know that person?
Yeah.
Who is that person?
They like to say in Charlottesville or in Lexington that half the town has written a book and the other half can't read it. It's one of those. That's an old joke about Lex Vegas, as they call it,
because Lex Vegas.
Yeah, they call it Lex Vegas. The locals do. It's especially the students at WNL, because there's Washington and Lee
right,
and VMI
right. And VMI,
and
right.
They're literally right next to each other.
Right,
the campuses like
on
are contiguous
ridge, on the same ridge.
Yeah,
right.
And it's beautiful. And one of my most favorite memories of the couple of years I spent in Lexington was I would take the babies over there in the double stroller over to VMI in the evenings when they would lower the flag and fire the cannon.
Right.
And it was
on the parade ground then.
Yeah,
it's just beautiful.
I don't care how many times I witnessed that. It was always so moving to see
chilling.
Those guys come out there to do that.
Yeah, it's chilling. Yeah, it takes you right back.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, VMI is a beautiful place.
And like Charlottesville, there's some world-class statuary. Some of the same folks who did the statues here in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else is going on?
I've got the Virginia History 101. You caught me off guard there. Virginia History 101, what we're going to do at the Senior Center is we're going to have a consecutive six-week class wherein we're going to talk about some of the big issues in early Virginia history, the Native Virginians or the Native Americans, as you will, tobacco, the first cash crop, slavery, the Yorktown campaign, of course, the last major campaign in the American Revolution took place right here in Virginia, then some of the early presidencies, Washington's presidency, and then architecture in the Jeffersonian period. So that's going to be great.
Good stuff.
And so for that and for the Civil War lecture and day trip series, you can get more information by going to www.seniorcenterinc.org or you can call the great folks at the travel office down there, 974-6538.
We're talking with Rick Britton, online at rickbritton.com, and our countdown and discussion of the 25 most significant battles of the Civil War that took place in Virginia now brings us to number 10.
That's right.
Which is the Battle of Fredericksburg. And review for us, if you can, really quick. This is late December, or it's late 1862.
Right, mid-December 1862.
The second year of the Civil War.
That's right.
And we've sort of seen a string of Confederate successes, right?
Right, except for Sharpsburg, except for the Battle of Antietam. So,
which was something of a draw, right? I mean, it was both just ripped each other apart.
Yeah, you could call it a draw, a tactical draw, in that on the battlefield, Robert E. Lee, despite the fact that he was outnumbered, held his ground. In fact, the very next day, he remained on the battlefield and remained in the same lines, almost like he was snubbing his finger, snubbing his thumb at McClellan and saying, come on and get it. We'll take another day of this. McClellan declined to attack another day. Good grief. Yeah. After that bloodletting, 25,000 killed and wounded in one day, September 17th, 1862, he declined, and then Robert E. Lee retreated. So you could say that it was a tactical draw because of what happened on the battlefield, but you would have to say that strategically the campaign was a Union victory. I mean, McClellan turned back an invasion of the North. And then, of course, in the typical McClellan manner, he was very laconic in pursuing Robert E. Lee. He took his time crossing back into northern Virginia. And there's that great scene where Lincoln, and they took a lot of photographs, Lincoln and some of his men and some of his advisors went up to visit with McClellan to try to prod him. And there's a great moment when Lincoln and Ward Lamon are on top of this ridge looking down on the camp of the Army of the Potomac, McClellan's army, and Lincoln, in just one of those moments, gosh, to be able to talk to Abraham Lincoln or to be able to just hear him speak, turns to Lamon and says, do you know what that is? Do you know what this is we're looking down at? And of course, Lamon says, of course, Mr. President, that's the Army of the Potomac. And he says, no, it's not. McClellan's bodyguard.
Wow.
Yeah. And so he had finally gotten, eventually, by early November, he had gotten to the end of his rope. And so he had to replace McClellan. McClellan was just not going to prosecute the war the way it really needed to be prosecuted, to put an end to the darn thing.
Lincoln wanted him to get in there and just be much more aggressive, take the fight to the enemy, and stop pulling your punches.
Eventually, that's what you had to do, right?
Yeah. And if you want to win the war, not just fight the war.
Eventually, he ended up with the kind of people who would do that. Your Grants, your Shermans, your Sheridans, the kind of men who would get in there and had the stomach to do what had to be done to put an end to it, to get it over
with. Did McClellan just have a different different vision of victory here? Because it almost seems like seems like, hey, we just slaughtered them. I don't, let them lick their wounds, and maybe that's enough, and they realize this is a lost cause, and they'll go home.
I think he had a lot of problems. I think one of them that really hampered his ability to move against the enemy was his perfectionism. So it had to be just right. He would always send requests for more of this, more of that. Right after the Battle of Sharpsburg, he requested more horses so that he could pursue the enemy. At different times, and Lincoln said, well, what have your horses been doing that have tired them at all? Lincoln trying to say, get with it, buddy. At one time, Lincoln sent a telegraph to him saying, if you're not using your army, I'd like to borrow it.
Oh my gosh.
Come on, what do you need from the president to get the idea that you need to be moving? So eventually, but that's a really good question. Let's get back to that for a second. We could go on and on for hours just talking about that. He was a perfectionist, but also I think he was determined. I think he already knew in 1862 that he was going to run for the presidency, and in fact he did.
McClellan.
In 1864 and lost, but he became governor of New Jersey for a while, after he was cashiered from the army, became governor, and then ran on the Democratic plank. And think about it this way. If the army is voting and you want all those guys to vote for you, what don't you do?
You don't
put them in the battle and get them killed. That's your constituency. You don't take them out and get them killed.
And you don't win the war as a result.
And you also don't win the war.
Yeah.
Right.
You just go from battle to battle and try to lose as few men as possible.
And some people might argue with me about this, but I've been thinking about this a lot lately. He was rarely on any of the battlefields. Now, and I'm not saying that he was a coward necessarily, but he just didn't have a stomach for the business.
We're talking with historian and award-winning author Rick Britton. His website is rickbritton.com. Let's continue our conversation with Rick Britton. December 1862, the Battle of Fredericksburg.
Okay, we're gonna stop first in November really quickly. Lincoln decided to replace McClellan, and he picked as his replacement Ambrose Burnside. Ambrose Burnside was a career soldier. He had invented a carbine. He had been in the Army for a while. He had been at First Manassas and some of the other battles. He had commanded a brigade at First Manassas, hadn't been all that successful. When they asked him if he could command the Army, he had already turned them down once before, saying that he wasn't up to the task. And here's kind of the interesting psychology about this, and I have friends who are wincing right now because they don't like me to talk about pop psychology when you talk about stuff like this.
You can do that on my show, though.
But thanks. I appreciate it. But when you got a guy who's a braggart like McClellan and always wanting more and telling you what a great job he's going to do and such a braggart and such an egomaniac. And not delivering. And then you get a guy who says, I don't think I'm up for it. It seems like a breath of fresh air. All of a sudden, it's honesty that you're getting from this guy, this future commander. Unfortunately, he was right.
He
wasn't up for it. So he starts off slowly. Then he decides he's going to try the overland route like had been tried before. And he maneuvers his army slowly down to Fredericksburg. Now,
is that where we get sideburns?
Yeah, we do. We get sideburns from Burnsides. Yeah, sideburns are named after him. But the time, they would have been called mutton chops. Or something like that.
And they were much thicker down the edge of the face.
And real fluffy down here. Right.
Got it. Okay.
Mutton chops. But then they became sideburns because of Burnsides. So he maneuvers his army down to Fredericksburg. Now, I say Fredericksburg, I mean across the river. Fredericksburg is right on the Rappahannock, and it's almost dead center between the two opposing enemy capitals, Richmond and Fredericksburg. So it's about 50 miles from each, dead center in the middle. It's on the Rappahannock. Fredericksburg sits on the southern bank. But saying that, the Rappahannock flows almost north and south rather than east-west at Fredericksburg. So Fredericksburg is on the southern bank. He maneuvers his army to the northern bank. He had all these grandiose ideas that he was going to capture the city on the southern bank. You need pontoons to create pontoon bridges to get across.
To move your foot soldiers.
A river as big as the Rappahannock, and at Fredericksburg, it's about 400 feet across. So that's significant. You know, it's over a football field across and fairly deep. So those were slow in arriving, so he couldn't advance. So meanwhile, by getting his army down to Fredericksburg, he telegraphed what he was going to do to Robert E. Lee. So Robert E. Lee was able to concentrate both wings of his army, the wing under Longstreet and the wing under Jackson, at Fredericksburg. Then they decide, despite the fact that his top commanders are telling him not to, he decides he's going to push right across the Rappahannock. Now, the interesting thing about that position, the Confederate position at Fredericksburg, is about a mile back from the Rappahannock, there's a fairly significant line of ridges that were perfect for Confederate defensive positions. So Robert E. Lee positioned his men along these ridges about a mile back. And of course, because of the strength of the defensive position, he actually wanted Burnside to attack him. And in fact, he wanted to attack him so much so that he got his men to refrain from digging in too much. And this is something that you could always tell. Remember, we're in the dead of winter. You could always tell in a distance with a looking glass, if you see red earth anywhere, that means somebody's been digging in. So that's an earthwork. So he actually encouraged his men not to dig in too much. Nonetheless,
unless they
did,
give away their position.
Or unless they give away the fact that it's a strong position and the enemy doesn't attack. You know, sometimes when you're in a great defensive position, like the Confederate Army had at Fredericksburg, you want the enemy to just like, come and get it.
Yeah.
We're going to tear you to pieces. Now, the most significant part of the Confederate defensive position was just behind Fredericksburg himself. Now, the line goes a good mile and a half below Fredericksburg, but just behind Fredericksburg, it's amazing. In fact, it's probably one of the strongest natural defensive positions ever used in the American Civil War. There's a road that runs parallel to the river right behind Fredericksburg, the Telegraph Road. Because it was long used, it was sunken. They built the people nearby in the adjoining buildings built a stone wall along a significant portion of that road. So that's at the base of this hill. Marye's Heights is a sunken road with a stone wall in front of it facing town. Now, because of the height of Marye's Heights behind it, I'm immediately behind the stone wall, Confederate artillery could be placed up there to fire over top the defenders in the stone wall. And then in some places, they were actually able to dig in the infantry in a position halfway up Marye's Heights. So you're talking about a position with almost triple, quadruple, you know, 10 times the strength of a normal position. So what happened was there's an early fight, and we need to go over this really quickly.
Did Burnside know this going in?
No, he did not know this.
He must not have known that Fredericksburg was going to be impossible to take.
No, he didn't know it, or he wouldn't have ordered these attacks. This position, especially with the artillery on top of Marye's Heights, was so strong that one of the Confederate artillery commanders was quoted as saying to Longstreet that when he opened up on that field in front, a chicken wouldn't be able to get across alive in that field between Fredericksburg and Marye's Heights. Now there was,
aren't there famous photographs from that wall and that road?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Oh yeah,
that rings a bell.
Yeah, there's some amazing photographs, but they were taken at a later battle.
Of course,
but yeah, they've been used to illustrate the Battle of Fredericksburg. But there was a second battle of Fredericksburg, and we'll get to that a little bit down the road. In fact, in just a couple, there was a fight on December 11th when they forced their way into town, and a Confederate brigade was able to hold them off for a while in the city itself. They drove them back. They marched an entire wing of the Federal Army into Fredericksburg. And then on that fateful day, December 13th, 1862, they attacked. Now, the way this was supposed to work is they attacked Jackson south of town first. And there was actually an initial breakthrough down there where it seemed like they were going to gain a victory. The way this was supposed to work was, as soon as it seemed that the attack south of town was working, Burnside was going to order an attack directly outside of town against Marye's Heights, so that those troops there, those Confederate troops there, couldn't be sent to reinforce their friends to the south. So when the attack seemed to be succeeding in the south, the Southern commander down there sent word to Burnside, it's working. So they started this attack outside of town. And then, of course, the attack south of town was sealed off, and they were forced back. And then Burnside, you could use any word you wanted, idiocy, kept throwing wave after wave of Union brigades at a time against the stone wall at Marye's Heights. At some point, I think they even lost track, but it's over a dozen independent brigade attacks up against Marye's Heights.
So they did get across the river into Fredericksburg.
They got across the river into Fredericksburg.
But they couldn't get up the hill.
They attacked Marye's Heights, and no Federal soldier even reached Marye's Heights. It was just slaughter on December 13th. So bad, in fact, that the Federal casualties...
December 13th, yeah.
December 13th, that the Federal casualties were over twice the Confederate casualties in the battle. About 11,000 Federals killed and wounded, to about 5,000 Confederates.
So the lessons, number one, Burnside may not be what we thought he was. And number two, the route to Richmond is not going to be through Fredericksburg.
Absolutely. Yeah, the route to Richmond at Fredericksburg was sealed shut. And anybody trying to attack a position on Marye's Heights came up against the infantry firing, leveling their rifled muskets over top of that stone wall, where hardly any men were killed and wounded because of the amazing protection that the sunken road and a stone wall in front of it afforded, and then that artillery firing over top of them,
yeah,
directly into the faces of the attacking infantry. Nobody, no Federal soldier even made it to the stone wall.
The First Battle of Fredericksburg, December 1862, in the second year of the U.S. Civil War. Rick Britton joins us once a week to explore the top 25 most significant Civil War battles that took place here in Virginia. And before we let you go, really quick, though, that was then that they sort of shut down in the winter, right? I mean, they didn't.
Right.
Not
normally
a lot goes
they did.
On.
In fact, it was even surprising that they fought in December at all, because normally they wouldn't have. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Rick, have a terrific week, and thank you so much.
You too. Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.